Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show. Okay, farming and harvest. This is interesting. I have neither farmed nor harvested.
Really?
So this will be an interesting one.
We should farm and harvest.
Yeah, I haven't done either one. So that'll be interesting.
If you farmed and harvested something,
yeah.
Would you pull it out of the ground and eat it immediately?
No. Good Lord.
Would you do it if I gave you $5?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, everybody, welcome to Season 2, Episode 7, Podcast for Good. My name is Philip Kerrigan. I am the program manager of the Washington State Combined Fund Drive. This is, as always,
Heather Lucas, the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Washington State Combined Fund Drive.
That is correct. We are joining you today to talk about a very unique thing we've never actually talked about on this podcast at all.
No.
And that is farming and harvest services.
Yeah.
This is interesting. This is going to be a road I don't know where we're going down.
Oh, yeah?
I have no idea.
So if I start quoting things to you that weren't true,
yeah,
you'd believe me.
I wouldn't know.
Nice.
It could be hashtag fake news, but I wouldn't know.
Hashtag I feel something evil brewing.
Yes. we're going to be joined by two different charities. Rotary First Harvest and the executive director, David Bobanek, from Snow Valley Tilth. It's the interim executive director, Libby Reed. Ooh, interim.
Interim.
Could there have been scandal? No.
Hashtag nefarious purposes.
Yes. We're pretty sure Libby got there through regular old...
Yeah, standard business.
Standard business.
Yeah. you could ask her if you'd like.
Yeah, maybe I will.
Okay,
I don't know.
Okay.
So we are actually ending September. We're entering into the frenzied pace of the annual giving campaign. And this is our last podcast before we basically hit the ground running next week with a podcast every day.
Oh, yeah.
Including the main ones, which are these ones that will still be available for you every other Friday.
Yeah.
But this is, we're about to hit it. So this is it. This is happening, people.
Yeah.
We're going to dive into our very first interview with David Bobanek in just a second, but we cannot do that without the usual question of the pod.
I kind of feel like you answered it already, but I'm going to ask.
Okay.
What was the last thing? Food type thing that you grew? Nothing ever?
No, that's not true. I mean, I may have said that in the cold open, but I have actually attempted to grow something.
What was it? The last thing.
The last thing I attempted to grow was carrots.
Okay.
Now, to be fair, I was like 11.
Okay.
When I did that.
Sure.
And you know, I mean, I felt like I did okay. They didn't grow as big as like
your store carrots.
I was hoping.
Yeah.
I mean, I was really hoping I could get something bigger. I also got too excited. I pulled them out of the ground too soon.
Oh.
So they were like little nibble carrots. They were nice. Tiny. They were
small. Nibble
smaller.
Carrots.
Yeah, they were
like little,
they were like carrot babies.
Carrot babies.
Yeah, so it wasn't as cool. Mm. But that was the last thing I harvested. I mean, we've never really actually lived in a spot where like that sort of thing was available to us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when we were living on the military base, you're not really doing a garden in your backyard.
Yeah.
And then when we moved to our other houses, we just didn't really have a backyard that would be able to accommodate that.
Yeah.
So I think carrots was the last thing I tried.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, from my family, we had space and garden availability since I was probably like, I don't know, 13.
Yeah.
So it's been a pretty standard thing throughout my life.
Okay.
This year, though, I attempted to plant two tomato plants and then did not water them at all.
Oh, good.
So they're still alive.
I read that's not that effective.
No, no, fact. Brondo, Gatorade, water, whatever. Is, like, you need to actually give them some kind of liquid.
Yeah.
And
That didn't work out all that good.
Yeah, so the tomato plants themselves are alive, but they have no flowers, they have no tomatoes, they have nothing.
Oh, wait, are they still growing in your backyard?
Yeah, they're still hanging out, and there's two of them in this big garden plot all by themselves.
Really?
That's it. So, yeah, this year was a fail.
Are you going to circle back and try it again?
Oh, yeah, next year, absolutely.
If you were going to be able to grow, like, I mean, it sounds like tomatoes are the thing you're going for, but if you were going to be able to grow one thing, is tomatoes the one thing you're growing?
This year, yes.
Oh, but I mean, like, overall.
Overall, I mean, like, I've got blueberry bushes, the deer keep eating. I've got strawberry plants, the squirrels keep eating.
Yeah.
And herbs, like mint and basil
parents,
and things.
My parents, because they are finally, you know, retired and, like, found a place where they can grow stuff.
Yeah.
They grow all the sort of berry, you know, they grow the strawberries and then the blackberries and then, well, the blackberries go wild, but, but the blueberries and then the raspberries.
Yeah, and getting some raspberries next year.
Yeah, and my kids literally just, they'll come, like, my son John will just go there and just spend an hour just pulling it off. And I love it because that's not something I did when I was a kid, so it's pretty cool.
Nice.
But if I were to grow one thing, I think I'd probably, I like cherry trees. That would be pretty cool.
I could grow cherries.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried lemon trees, and every year that I've had two lemon trees, one of them is sad, and the other one's like, hey, I might make it.
Yeah.
But then they don't really produce anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I feel like they gotta go a long time, don't they?
They do, but they also probably don't do well in the climate, say, from September through the rest of the year.
Good point. I mean, what you need to grow out here is something that can take rain for 10 and a half months.
Yeah, exactly.
And doesn't need the sun necessarily.
Yep.
Yeah. So that has been the Farming Channel. Thank you very much for listening to this spectacular podcast.
CFD NPR.
CFD. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into the interview with David Bobanek from Rotary First Harvest. Here he is.
All right. I'm here with Executive Director David Bobanek from Rotary First Harvest. David?
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
So can you give us a little history about Rotary First Harvest and what your organization does for the community?
Sure. It was an organization that started out in 1982 as basically an idea that one Rotarian had in the greater Seattle area to try to get more produce into hunger relief organizations in his neighborhood.
Okay.
So we became a Rotary Club project and then a district project, and now we're a standalone nonprofit. Long history, starting in 1982, but our focus has always been to get more produce into hunger relief organizations through partnerships, collaborations, any way that we can do that.
Okay. And as far as Rotary goes, I mean, you said that the founding member was a Rotarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What kind of relationship has the Rotary had with your organization since?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's as most people know, Rotary is a service organization, and you'll find it in most communities around Washington State.
Yeah, we have a garden across the street, actually.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what Rotary clubs will do is they'll find service projects in communities to help make their community a better place to live, but it also reaches all the way across the planet.
Yeah.
You know, so eradicating polio in communities in countries like Afghanistan, like Pakistan. So it's really, there is no analog organization to Rotary. It really does some pretty amazing work, both at the very hyper-local level, which is what we do, and on an international level. So as a Rotary project, that simply means that we get a lot of support from Rotary clubs and individual Rotarians, but as a standalone nonprofit, we also receive support from corporations, foundations, and other individuals. What Rotary does really is helps us to connect into this powerful network in communities all across Washington State. And so board members are Rotarians, all the staff are Rotarians, and we can use those Rotary connections to really reach into local communities in ways that other organizations might not be able to.
Sure. Do you find that you get a large number of volunteers from Rotary clubs?
We do. The second and fourth Saturdays of every month, we have what we call Rotary work parties, Rotary First Service work parties. And we'll go into one of our food bank warehouse partners, like a Northwest Harvest or a Food Lifeline, and we'll get up to 100 to 120 Rotarians to help us repack some of the produce that we get in. There are also Rotarians that are serving on the boards of nonprofits all across, or food banks all across Washington State, as well as volunteering. So we'll help to coordinate volunteer groups to go in as well.
Nice. So I saw on your website a little bit of information about the Farm to Food Pantry Initiative.
Yeah.
So what is that, and what is Rotary First Harvest's role with that initiative?
Yeah, so just a quick step back. One of the things that we try to do is to be like a almost a, an incubator for finding ways to support nonprofit or food banks all across Washington State to help them do a better job of providing produce to the people that are coming into their doors. And so we really work as a support organization in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
We'll also provide direct service when it comes to getting produce into a food bank warehouse.
Sure.
The Farm to Food Pantry Initiative is a program that was born from a series of interviews that we did with small-scale growers several years ago. We called them grower roundtables.
Okay.
And what we wanted to do was find out, I mean, there are 30,000 farmers in Washington State.
Yeah.
Right. And so each one of those farmers has his or her own story and his or her own operation. So we really wanted to dive down into what can we do from the perspective of the hunger relief community to be better partners with farmers. And so one of the things that we heard from the farmers at those roundtable conversations was, especially the small scale farmers, holy cow, there are times of the year when we almost need to come into a food bank ourselves to get help. And the fact that a couple of $100 coming into a farm at a certain time of the year can make all the difference to them.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, okay, that's really, that's interesting information. So how, what do we do to like help farmers, help food banks?
Yeah.
And so we created the, we worked with the Washington State Department of Agriculture to develop a Farm to Food Pantry initiative. And it started out as a pilot where we did it in three different areas of the state, where we used a little bit of funding that would then go to a local organization, and they would set up contracts to purchase produce from growers.
Okay.
And what we found is that, one, it helped the farmers to connect more deeply with the hunger relief organizations and vice versa. But it also helped to really expand the variety of produce that's available to the people that are coming into the hunger relief organizations. So, you know, the first couple of years, it was, we were developing contract models, sometimes even teaching some of the small scale farmers how to do a wholesale contract with their local food bank. And what we found, what was really interesting, is that we found for every pound of produce that is purchased, growers are donating 3 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's a really impactful return on investment, but it also helps to support, you know, especially in rural parts of the state, it helps to support that food economy that's so integral to some of the smaller communities.
Yeah.
And so the program has grown over the past few years to now we're in 17 counties across Washington State with the initiative. And we hope to be in every county over the next couple of years. So we're hoping to continue to expand it. But it's been, you know, every year for the Farm to Food Pantry Initiative is a learning experience. So we're constantly fine-tuning the initiative or the way that we're doing that work, and really taking best practice ideas from the participating sites.
Yeah.
And so, and they're the ones that are coming up with these wonderful ideas. We just bring all those in, all those ideas together, and then make sure we're sharing them back out through the hunger relief system.
Well, I'm sure you're finding a good idea is happening in Wenatchee that nobody knows about in Squim, for example.
That's exactly right, or vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the best ideas have come from, and this happens uniformly with any of the hunger relief work that we do, some of the best ideas come from those really small communities where they have to rely on initiative and they have to rely on creativity because they just don't have the resources that are maybe available in some other parts of the state. And so, yeah, it's and it's wonderful because, again, we're incubating these ideas and then we're sharing them out.
Nice.
So we've really enjoyed that partnership, and it's been a wonderful way for the Washington State Department of Agriculture to be involved in a fairly unique way in reaching out to growers through hunger relief organizations and supporting those food programs in other parts of the state.
Do you have any idea what kind of impact the program has had since you guys have been involved?
Yeah, it's had in a couple of ways. So what we do is we put together a report at the end of every year. Mm-hmm. And so we basically break it down into quantitative data, which is, you know, pounds of whatever the product is. That's why we know there's for every pound purchased, there's 3 pounds donated.
Sure.
But also more qualitative. So what is the impact that it's having in the community? And that's where we get these wonderful stories about relationships and partnerships that are developed with the growers. And we also hear of the impact that it's having on the people. I mean, ultimately, why we do this work is because of the people that come into a hunger relief organization.
Yeah.
You know, when they open that door every day, that's the most important.
That's the end goal.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So that produce that might not otherwise be there to provide a healthy foundation for somebody's diet now is there. And last year with the program, one of our learning points was that the hunger relief organizations can learn from the people that are coming into their programs.
Yeah.
What are they missing from their diet? What would they like to have in their diet? You know, the nutrient density. And then so you overlay the nutrient density, what people want to have at the program and what they'll use. And then you go back to the growers and say, well, here's what we'd like you to grow. You know, so ironically, in some parts of the state, you know, the most popular thing is broccoli, you know, or something that's really good, nutritious food that you know is going to get used by the people that are coming into the food banks.
So you get actual data to say, yeah, people don't care for leeks so much. Grow some broccoli instead.
Or kale or other things. But it also varies depending on where you are in the state, which is also interesting. I mean, you know, Washington State is not necessarily homogenous.
Yeah.
You know, what's popular in one particular part of the state may not be in another part of the state. And so this initiative allows us to really fine-tune the way the produce is being brought into the
program. So it's more about the community as opposed to just flat-out doing what you've always done.
Yeah,
a grower.
That's exactly right. And in some parts of the state, some things grow well
or
better than in other parts of the state.
Yeah.
So it's been a really interesting program, and we've been able to do that because of some of the other programs that we've built as an organization previously, like our Harvest Against Hunger program and a few other things.
Nice. So in your experience, I mean, you're going all over the state and you're working with all these different farms and growers. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to change the public's perception as far as imperfect produce or produce that's cosmetically not beautiful?
Yeah.
You know, like you go into a store, you see a carrot that's, you know, a weird shape.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's really difficult to get people to accept the fact that it's still a carrot?
Well, it can be. I think, you know, so this gets us to a different part of the work that we do. Mm-hmm. So on one level, we're reaching out and doing Farm to Food Pantry Initiative, and that's hyper-local. But on another level, just this morning, as before I walked in here to talk with you, I was finding a truck that was able to bring over a 40,000-pound load of pears from a donor in the Wenatchee area that's going to deliver them to one of our partner program warehouses.
Okay.
Every one of those pears is just as nutritious and, for the most part, just as attractive as what you'll find in a grocery store.
Uh-huh.
But for some reason, maybe they're off pressure. Maybe they've got a little bit of sunburn.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're an odd shape. They're not going to be what is called saleable.
Yeah.
You know, and that, so it, we look back through the history of the way the grocery industry has kind of trained us to buy with our eyes.
Yeah.
And that's something that I do. I mean, you know, I know what's going on, and I still will look and, you know, every Granny Smith apple that you go and you see at a grocery store is that same color green and it's the same shape. But yeah. obviously that's not the way they grow in nature.
Yeah.
and so, you know, one of the things that we try to do is to find ways to get as much of the produce that's not going to be saleable mm-hmm. Into the hands of those who might not otherwise be able to get it.
Yeah.
So through the hunger relief organizations. But I think, you know, when it comes to the idea of food waste, you know, we're kind of careful how we use the term food waste because for a farmer, if you talk to a farmer, if we had a farmer sitting here with us, he or she would say, well, there's no such thing as food waste because they can use a lot of the stuff that they have on the farm, whether it's composting or some other ways. But it's there is something called food loss. And that is food that is not going to be consumed by a human.
So food loss is a more important factor for a grower than food waste is.
Yeah. I mean, food waste is what happens when that scary drawer at the bottom of our refrigerator suddenly starts bubbling or whatever. And so we're really focusing on that food loss. So it's, you know, food that has not gone bad mm-hmm. or food that is not necessarily in immediate danger of going bad and being inedible and making sure that we're getting that into the hunger relief system. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, as we said earlier, into the hands of somebody that is coming into a food bank at a time of crisis in their lives and just needs a little bit of help.
So you mentioned contracts as something that you work with farmers and growers. Mm-hmm. And then you said that there was a truck coming over with all these pears.
Yeah.
So clearly, contracts and trucks don't seem to be like a farm thing, a food bank thing. No. How does that work with you guys?
Yeah. And so with, you know, there are days when we get to go out and go on farms and talk with farmers. And those are good days.
Yeah.
But there's a process that's involved. And it really is.
Right?
Yeah. The industry of logistics. And I think that's really, if we go back to the history of the organization, that's really been where Rotary First Harvest has been able to develop that network. So there are. So we've established that there's produce that's available. And maybe not going to get into the hands of a consumer through a grocery store or some other outlet. But a truckload of apples, say, in Wenatchee is not going to do too many people a lot of good if you can't get it from where it is to a distribution center where it can get out to the food bank network.
Yeah.
And so we partner with a lot of trucking companies around Washington State who will have an open backhaul.
Okay.
So the truck may be delivering one way. So maybe a truck is delivering into Wenatchee and it has to come back to Seattle or vice versa.
Sure.
That's called a deadhead.
Okay.
And so we will work with trucking companies to arrange for them to, if they're going to be running a deadhead anyway, if that trailer is going to come back empty, to go and pick up the produce for us and then bring it into one of our hunger relief partner programs.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's almost like a three-legged stool where you have, you know, you've got the farmer, you've got the packing house with the produce, and then you've got the transportation industry, and you need that, and then you also have the hunger relief network.
Uh-huh.
And so if one of those goes away, they're all equally important. If one of those goes away, the stool falls over.
Sure.
But if you've got all three of those components, then you can move 40,000 pounds of pears from one place to another and get them distributed to those in need.
So as far as that third leg, the food distribution centers,
mm-hmm.
how many centers and food banks and food pantries are you working with?
Yeah, so we work with a number of them depending on the size of the donation.
Okay.
So for a 40,000 pound load of potatoes, carrots, onions, apples, pears, whatever it may be, there's a limited number of programs in Washington State that can handle those effectively.
Sure.
So organizations like Northwest Harvest, mm-hmm. for example, have large distribution facilities, and they can absorb that kind of product in, and then they distribute it in turn out to
smaller,
like 400 food banks and meal programs across Washington State. That's roughly how many there are. And so we don't want to necessarily recreate this whole distribution process.
Sure.
We just want to plug that product that we can get into it as efficiently as we can so that it gets distributed, again, efficiently and without additional or incurring additional costs. And so, but if we do get it like a $5,000 or 5,000 pound donation in an area, we'll send that to maybe smaller food bank that we'll share with three or four other food banks,
okay,
for example.
Yeah.
But one of the things, and one of the reasons that we started a program called Harvest Against Hunger is, again, I mentioned 30,000 growers across Washington State. How do you manage all those relationships?
I mean,
you know, even somebody at the Department of Agriculture can't manage all those relationships.
Yeah.
The way we found, we place AmeriCorps Vista out at communities all around Washington State to develop like little mini Rotary First Harvest models in their communities.
Okay.
And so that then helps to localize the connections between farmers and hunger relief organizations. So when it comes to 200 pounds of spinach or 200 pounds of kale or 200 pounds of whatever it may be that needs to be harvested from a farmer's field and taken into the hunger relief organization locally, they have a system and they have a network in place that will allow them to take advantage of those. Because if I were to try to manage 100, 200 pound donations in a day, it becomes overwhelming.
Yeah.
So if you decentralize the process and you make those connections strong at a local level, then you can take advantage of the small scale. And those all add up.
Yeah.
200 pounds of really highly perishable but highly nutritious product will make a huge amount of difference on a serving day at a food bank in a small community.
It kind of sounds like taking a model from some company that doesn't work with food at all, like Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Having that kind of distribution idea or successful business practices for other companies and applying it to just this model.
Yeah.
This kind of topic, essentially.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, that's, and I think that that's, you know, kind of, that's the differentiator for Rotary First Harvest is that we try to find solutions mm-hmm. to some of these challenges that are logistical challenges, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And again, those solutions may look different depending on if it's 200 pounds or 40,000 pounds.
Sure.
But, it, you know, ultimately it's all produce that needs to get into the hands of somebody.
So you said that growers have said a big problem they experience is we have to go to food banks ourselves at some point.
Mm-hmm.
When you've done these roundtables and you've talked to them, what other kind of problems are they having where they all seem to have like the same issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it depends on the scale and the size of the farm. So, uh-huh. you know, some of the more established, the larger scale farms don't necessarily have that kind of an issue. Definitely the smaller scale farms. I mean, it's just a tough business for people to be in. There's harvesting. So, you know, I think one of the universal issues for a lot of farmers can be labor.
Okay.
You know, just trying to find help getting the produce harvested.
Sure.
And the other really challenging thing for a lot of small to even medium scale growers is distribution and transportation.
Okay.
You know, so how do you... say you're a small-scale, medium-scale grower in Carnation, how do you get the product from your field to your customers?
Yeah.
And what do those customers look like? It could be restaurants, it could be individuals through a CSA, or it could be through a market. But you know, how do you get it from your field to your customer? That's a challenge, and that's one that's it's getting more and more expensive to try to find ways to do that.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, traffic on the I-5 corridor doesn't help any for gas costs.
No, right. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on growers to provide really good produce at a low price point. And so that can be challenging because a lot of the other costs that they're facing on a day-to-day basis, I mean, land costs alone are really challenging in certain parts of the state. And so... you know, they're in a vice.
Sure.
You know, they're being squeezed with increasing costs, and then trying to keep that price point for their product low enough that people can buy those things.
And as far as labor goes, I think that a public perception is that it's hard work for little pay. Is it something that you've seen or heard from farmers where the pay is the problem? It's the labor, the actual physical work? Like, how do they get people interested in that work?
Well, and I think what we're seeing now is how do they get people? I mean, it's
flat out.
Flat out, yeah. I mean, in California earlier this year, there was a pretty significant labor shortage.
Yeah.
Just in terms of having enough people to pick some of the crops. Because, you know, there are some crops are pretty easy to mechanize.
Okay.
But there are a lot of crops that aren't, that still have to be picked by hand.
Sure.
And so just finding people to do that work can be challenging for them. And yeah, I mean, that whole idea of how do you pay people the value of getting that product out of the field, it is hard work. It is physical work.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and farmers know that better than anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, farmers, if they had 30 hours a day during the harvest season, it still wouldn't be enough time. So, you know, the farmers know that there's a lot of hard work, and it's really challenging just to be able to pay people the value of, you know, going out into the fields and doing that harvesting work.
So have the staff at Rotary First Harvest been part of that process, gone out and picked produce?
Yeah. So we haven't really talked that much about the Harvest Against Hunger program, where that's the one where we place the AmeriCorps Vista out at locations around the state. And so through Harvest Against Hunger, one of the things that we, when we first started the program, it was back when Governor Gregoire was still in office.
Sure.
And it was at the height of the recession, and we were really challenged as nonprofits to do more, like to find ways to do more to help people in Washington State. And so we developed this program with AmeriCorps Vista to place these folks out in communities and build initiatives in communities all around Washington State. Part of what they do is they set up gleaning and produce recovery programs.
Okay.
And gleaning is going out into the field. I mean, it's based on this ancient term from, I think, the Old Testament, which is to go out into the field and pick, you know, the farmers are asked to leave a portion in the Old Testament. We're asked to leave a portion of their field for those who couldn't help themselves to be able to get that produce into them.
Okay.
And so gleaning is going out and harvesting crops that aren't otherwise going to be harvested, or maybe the farmer already went through and did a first pass, got the best product was for that harvest, and there's still going to be crop in the field. So taking that crop and gathering it and then taking it to a local food bank, that's gleaning. And we certainly have done that, like in the apple orchards or out in fields. I mean, I think still the wettest I've ever been, it was a carrot harvest in the Burlington area.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was November and it was muddy and it was, but everybody that did it was smiling and having a great time.
That's good.
You know, and then we took the carrots into the Hunger Relief Organization, and that's, you know, that's the best thing. When you walk in to a food bank or a meal program and you've got fresh produce directly from the field that then goes into the hands of people that are coming in the door, that's pretty magical.
Nice.
It's a really nice experience. But yeah, so I've worked in orchards on gleans, and it's hard work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really challenging. But it's, you know, for the volunteers, it's a really nice way to get involved and to give back.
Yeah, I bet it's very rewarding.
It is.
Yeah. So, clearly, farms exist to feed people, but do you find, in your experience, that farms are existing more and more to feed people in emergency situations as opposed to just the general public?
There are some instances of food bank farms that have been developed. And so, commercial farms, generally, you know, the idea is I'm going to grow produce and I'm going to sell it at a high value or a high return.
Sure.
You know, that's always what farmers
they want to make a profit.
Want to do. They want, you know, they want to be able to turn the lights on the next day. But there are also some models in place now that are food bank farms, and we've helped to develop a number of them. One is Elk Run Farm, which is in South King County, and it's a former golf course.
Nice.
That was converted into a farm that is a community-based farm that's growing produce specifically for 12 different food banks in South King County.
Okay.
And so if you know South King County, it's a very diverse community.
Yeah.
Lots of different nationalities and ethnic groups are represented. And so they're growing some pretty specific vegetables to be distributed to those folks. So there are instances of these nonprofit, and the farm is a part of the work of the South King County Food Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
So there are models that are cropping up in Vancouver and on Whidbey Island.
Yeah.
Tacoma has Mother Earth Farm, where there are farms that are specifically growing vegetables,
yeah,
or some other produce for food banks.
Do you think that model is going to continue to grow?
I think it will, you know, because one of the things that is really great, I mean, you have the output of the farm.
Yeah.
And so there's produce as one of the outputs. But the other is the community involvement. So when you can have, like at Elk Run Farm, they partner with the local schools and they'll have high school kids come and work on the farm.
Okay.
And whether it's planting, whether it's harvesting, whatever the work they're doing may be, they're getting educated about the food system.
And they're getting volunteer experience,
yeah,
in the community.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what's been kind of fascinating is to see how some of the younger people that are getting involved at the food bank farms,
yeah,
that's what they want to do as a career.
Wow.
You know? And so one of the real challenges has been the aging of the farmer population.
Okay.
So one of the things that we're starting to see is a number of people that are younger wanting to become farmers.
Okay.
I mean, 10 years ago,
That was unheard of. You're supposed
absolutely
to go to college, get a job with a button up.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. And so there's a tremendous amount of interest now in food waste, in food systems,
uh-huh,
in hunger relief. And, you know, within the Venn diagram of those three things are farms.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of interest now in young people getting involved in farming. And it's very gratifying. I mean, it's wonderful to see. And
yeah,
I understand, because when you're at a farm, it's a pretty special place to be.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people may have this, you know, mental image of a farm not being a great place to be. But boy, being out on a farm is, and doing that work and harvesting is, again, it's pretty magical.
I can imagine for young people, there is a little bit of that connection to community.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know, social media, technology, all the stuff that's out there that exists in the ether, it's not so personal.
Right.
So being on a farm and understanding where your food comes from, that'd be a way to connect you back to the planet.
Yeah, it's a super visceral connection,
yeah,
right? It's the being in the dirt and doing that work. And I should say, some of my favorite Instagram sites are farmers,
yeah,
and farm sites. I mean, it's, but you know, the idea that, you can go and do this work and it's hands-on and you can really see the labor,
yeah,
and it's very tangible. So, there's a certain reward structure,
yeah,
there that,
yeah,
you can't get other ways.
Yeah, you would definitely be able to see where you started, where you ended up with that,
yeah,
that produce at the end,
yeah,
of the day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, the other thing that's really interesting to me about farms and farmers and agriculture in general is that, you know, a lot of farmers are very, very smart people. They,
mm-hmm,
know there's a lot of science that's involved in farming.
Yeah.
There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of business entrepreneurship that they have to be adept at in order to be successful. And so, you know, some of the things that small to medium scale farmers have to do, the level of creativity and the level of business acumen is really remarkable.
It's not really talked about, yeah.
No, and you know, they cannot be, they can't just have one talent set,
sure,
and just rely on that talent set,
yeah,
to, you know, it has to change on a daily basis. I mean, they're wearing multiple hats multiple times a day. Like, somebody's got to figure out, okay, what is the organic compound that's missing in this equation, that's, you know, that I'm not able to grow the kale the way,
yeah,
I want to. And then, you know, they have to suddenly switch to the other side of their brain, which is, okay, well, what's my distribution model for how I'm going to get this kale to, you know, five different drop sites?
Yeah.
on a Wednesday when I-5 is completely backed up or something like that. I mean, you know, so they're
having
really,
to go back and forth between all these different things.
Yeah. And it's, you know, they have to figure out how to make their business model work.
Sure.
And again, so, you know, coming back to the Farm to Food Pantry initiative, that's, you know, we're constantly getting feedback from growers about the their participation in it, and trying to find ways to fine tune it to make that participation easier for them. And, you know, they're very good at coming up with some recommendations that we might not have thought of, because they come from a very unique perspective.
And they're hands-on there, so they have a different perspective.
That's
always.
Right. And, you know, one of the neat things about it is that we're also able to find ways to create solutions that benefit both the farmers and the food banks.
Okay.
So in Northeast Washington, in Colville, they've created a program that's picking up from growers and from farms, and they're doing this combination of helping to distribute at a drop site where some of that produce may be sold at one of the local grocery stores, and at the same time, on that same trailer, they're distributing to one of the local food pantries.
Okay.
And so it's this solution that they've come up with, because the farmers and the food pantries are willing to work together to find a common solution that's going to benefit both of them.
Yeah.
So it's been neat to see development of some of those projects.
Nice. So let's say someone hears this podcast and they want to start giving to Rotary First Harvest. Can you talk about what donations do for your organization?
Sure. So I talked about our basically what we call our core work, which is getting truckload-sized donations of produce into the Hunger Relief Network. And if you were to make a $10 donation, $5 every pay period, that would equal about 300 pounds of fresh produce going into a hunger relief organization. So we're able to get 300 pounds of produce for every $10.
Nice.
And that's a pretty efficient model. Again, because we don't have trucks and we don't have warehouses, we're using existing resources to get that out.
So that's 10 pounds, so that's 1 month is 300 pounds of food.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Very nice job.
Thanks.
Yeah. So do you have any upcoming events or any other programs, things that are coming up that are fundraisers that you guys are hosting?
We have a Hearts and Wine event that's happening in February, and it's basically it's a wine tasting event, and it's an auction for Rotary First Harvest, and it's happening in early February, so the second Friday in February, I believe that's February 9th in the Seattle area. People can go onto the firstharvest.org website and learn more about that. We don't do a lot of events. One of the things that if people are interested and they hear this podcast and they think, well, I want to get involved in hunger relief in my community, through our Harvest Against Hunger program and through the work that we do with a number of other partners, we could certainly get you connected. So you could go out and glean carrots in November and be as wet and cold as you've ever been, or you could spend a nice sunny day in an orchard helping to pick apples that otherwise would go to waste.
Wouldn't
get picked. And so, you know, again, trying to find ways to improve the overall food system in communities across Washington State, that's really at the core of what we're doing as an organization.
Right on. Well, David, thank you for coming onto the podcast and telling me about Rotary First Harvest.
You're welcome. And thanks for the opportunity. We really
Absolutely.
Like sharing it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so that was David Bobanek with Rotary First Harvest. Interesting interview with him. We're going to dive into Snow Valley Tills and the interim executive director, Libby Reed. Here she is talking about her organization. Okay, so we're joined here by interim. Is that still the tag, interim?
Interim executive director, yes.
Libby Reed from Snow Valley Tills.
There you go.
There it is. thank you very much for coming on the show, Libby.
Thanks for having us.
So can you walk us through a little bit of the history of Snow Valley Tills and what it is you do for the community?
Sure thing. Snow Valley Tills was started by a group of sustainable farmers in the Snoqualmie Valley 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And those farmers really were looking to build community and support one another at a time where there weren't a lot of organic farmers and sustainable farmers in the area. And they started out by just having potlucks once a month, getting together and sharing ideas and resources. And 14 years later, there's an organization with five staff members. And what we do is really support sustainable farmers in the greater Snohomish watershed. So that's the Snoqualmie Valley and the Snohomish Valley. And we help farmers start new businesses, build their businesses, and we help established farmers grow.
Okay. Nice. Okay, excellent.
Nice. So, like most people, they buy produce and vegetables, fruits from like a supermarket or a name brand store. So do you think it's easier now for local farmers to get their produce into these bigger markets, or is it still a challenge?
You know, I think it's still a challenge for small farmers to get their produce into wholesale markets.
Okay.
That is, I don't think the supermarkets are set up for that, and small farmers don't necessarily have the volume to supply them.
Sure.
So small farmers in the area, and I'm talking between, you know, a half acre to an acre to 20 to 40 acres, really rely on direct market sales. So farmers market sales, direct market sales to restaurants, and then some of our local grocery outlets like PCC and some others in the area.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, there are all sorts of different documentaries out there now, Forks Over Knives, and even movies like, or documentaries like The Corporation that talk a little bit about this sort of stuff. Can you articulate some of the benefits behind consuming locally grown, sustainable produce?
Sure thing. So part of our mission is to support food positive policies in the area. Supporting the local food economy is something that's very important for everyone living in this area. Local food is a really great way to consume fresh, nutritious
it's vegetables. It didn't make a long travel, a long journey.
Exactly.
To get to your plate.
A lot of the food that people eat ends up getting to their plate weeks, sometimes months after it was harvested. And a lot of food goes through sort of a degradation over that time, even if it's stored at the temperature it should be. So, eating local, healthy food gives people the opportunity to taste, to really taste what fresh food tastes like.
That's what a carrot is.
Exactly. Well, and you have people say who've eaten carrots their whole life, oh, this is the best carrot I've ever eaten in my life. And you understand sort of the power of that. Both from a personal, like physical perspective, you know, your body appreciates that nutrition. But it's also an engagement with the food that we eat, which in this day and age is harder to connect with.
What, how can people kind of tell if a local farm stand is bringing in things locally and those sort of things? Is it really like if you see a smaller farm stand, chances are they've probably gotten most of their produce from locally farmed areas?
So the one thing that we always encourage people to do is talk to the farmers that you know.
Okay.
So if you're buying food from a farm stand, talk to the person there and ask them where their produce comes from.
Okay.
There are farm stands that are hosted by small farms that really produce most of the vegetables that they sell there. There are other farm stands that probably bring in vegetables from Eastern Washington, which is still very
pretty
regionally
local.
Focused.
It's not like Argentina.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
But really, one of the most important things to do is just open a dialogue with the people that grow and sell food. And I think that really helps the growers understand what the consumers are looking for and what they're interested in, but it also allows the growers to educate folks about, you know, what the true cost of growing vegetables is in this region and what the benefits are and how we can all work together to create a vibrant economy.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
Speaking of vegetables in this region, as far as the Snow Valley goes, what kind of produce is coming out of that area?
I would say we have about 45 member farms that are members of Snow Valley Tilth. And by and large, those are diversified vegetable operations.
Okay.
So market farms. Some work more on a wholesale level. But most of those folks are selling direct to consumer.
Okay.
Awesome. When I think of a farm, I always just think of the produce, the stuff's being grown in the ground. But there's also livestock farms as well. What does the livestock farm look like in the Snow Valley area?
So we also have quite a few livestock farmers. I think meat production in this area is more difficult on a sort of retail sales basis because of the regulations required.
Okay.
So most of our livestock operators will sell direct to consumer. So selling quarters, halves, or wholes of pork or beef, same with chicken. So there are a substantial number of livestock producers in the Snoqualmie and Snohomish Valleys. I would say most of them are not raising meat that you can find in your grocery store because of the USDA regulations.
That intrigues me.
Well, Philip is a meatitarian.
You are a meatitarian. Only meat.
I mean, I'll have a quarter of the plate can have some vegetable room.
Potatoes?
That's better than nothing.
I know. It's not great.
So USDA regulations are there for a very important reason, are the WSDA regulations.
Right.
And it just so happens that there are not a lot of processing facilities in this area that are easily accessed by smaller producers.
Sure.
Oh, interesting.
And so that, I think, is the real hurdle, and it's one of the things that we're trying to do working with our partners in the area to create more opportunities
them. We purchased a quarter of a cow one time.
Yeah,
from a local livestock farmer. It was delicious.
It filled a substantial part of your
freezer. It was, I had red meat for about a year
but
and a half.
But it is, I mean, I think once you experience that kind of flavor,
you don't really go back. I want to hit on something that's in your mission that I think is something that people talk about a lot, and that is the concept of organic produce. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of chatter around, when this sort of movement was coming into play about 14, 15 years ago, because documentaries were starting to come out and more education was starting to happen, everybody just flocked toward the idea of it had to be organic, right? And then, of course, it started to enter into grocery stores because specifically out here, it felt like the grocery stores really saw that was where folks were going. And so all of a sudden you saw everything. You saw huge sections of organic things at Fred Meyer or Albertsons or wherever. And everyone went, oh, that's great. They sell organic. But now you're starting to hear things like, well, really the ingredients, if you get it certified organic, only has to have about 10, 20, 30% of it has to be organic. Can you speak a little bit about the struggles of making sure that something is organic and how people may be a little bit like not all the way informed about what organic produce really is?
So there's certified organic.
Yeah.
And those are the products with the green and white label.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I would say that movement has really exploded over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
To where it's a lot more accessible than it used to be. And what used to be a very sort of homegrown, local organic,
you do some real searching to find it.
Organic movement has really turned into, the large scale agriculture that is prevalent these days for it to be so available in all the supermarkets.
Right.
I would say that it comes back to what I mentioned before, which is it's really important to speak to either the people that purchase the food that you buy or the farmers that grow the food that you're purchasing.
Uh-huh.
Because at least in this region, people are open to something different than the organic label, the USDA mm-hmm. organic label, and really just want to know the way in which the food was produced.
Right.
So the way in which the animals were raised or the vegetables were produced, and having that face-to-face conversation, say with a farmer, mm-hmm. telling you, you know, I might not be certified organic, however, these are the practices I use to grow, mm-hmm. I think has allowed for the conversation to become a little less black and white.
Yeah.
Okay.
And for consumers to understand that that USDA label isn't necessarily required mm-hmm. for vegetables to be sustainably produced.
Okay. See, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, it's all, you know, a lot of it is about being an informed consumer. And,
right.
And if I think if a consumer doesn't know what questions to ask, the best thing to do is to ask your farmer.
Yeah.
What should I be asking about the vegetables right. that I buy? Like, what's important for me to know?
What's yeah. really advantageous about where we kind of where we live in the South Puget Sound area, and then also up and down the I-5 corridor, is that we're pretty close to being on the cutting edge of a lot of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you know, we visited the Midwest recently and grew up there. You know, I think that those are more mass produced sort of farms, a lot of them. And there's not as much of a call for organic and sustainable stuff. So you see smaller farm stands out here.
Yeah.
There's about 5 or 6 here in the Olympia area yeah. that you can actually go, literally you can talk to the person. And they are interested in talking to you about
yes.
it too.
Yeah.
That's what's really cool too.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's true. I lived in the Midwest for about 20 years. And I think I found there that the USDA organic certification was a lot more important. I
yeah.
think because of sort of the need to differentiate themselves from
right.
That big ag.
Yeah. Yeah.
Conventional ag.
Right.
That's so prevalent
there. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've talked on podcasts before with different charities about like population growth and how that affects things like housing and transportation. Mm-hmm. So as far as Office of Financial Management, they say that by 2040, we're supposed to get 2 million more people to our state. So if we get 2 million more people to our state, how do you think it'll be more difficult to maintain the farmlands that we have now? Or would we be able to increase that? Or would we see a decrease in farmland in our area?
Well, I think we are really pushing to maintain farmland that exists and mm-hmm. and grow farm businesses in the area. So, I mean, King County, Seattle is sandwiched by two of the fastest growing counties in the
yeah.
nation.
Yeah, because nobody can live there anymore.
Exactly. and so
it's funny because it's true.
The surrounding areas are really feeling that development pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are lucky that in some of those areas, agricultural land has been placed into protection districts.
Oh, good.
Oh, nice.
But not all of that land is that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it becomes incredibly important for people to begin to express their feelings about the need for open space.
Yeah. Yeah.
For productive lands.
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, agriculture or mm-hmm. other sort of open space
yeah.
areas. I think we see that the difficulty that we see in King County right now is a real land access issue where the price of land is increasing beyond what farmers can afford.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they're really sandwiched into leasing in that area.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that is problematic for farmers because their livelihood depends on the land. And
yeah.
so if they only know from a year-to-year basis where they're going to be, and they don't know that they're going to be that same place the next year,
right.
it can make a business, you know, really unstable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Snow Valley Tilth is really trying to help connect, especially farmers who are, you know, within the first 5 years of starting their farm businesses, mm-hmm. With landowners who are looking to lease their land.
Yeah.
And yeah. trying to help make that connection. There's a lot of other efforts in the area with our partners, mm-hmm. Like PCC Farmland Trust,
mm-hmm.
The Tilth Alliance,
yeah.
and King County is working together on a working farmland partnership to try to create access throughout the region for farmers.
Nice. Cool.
So let's say someone hears the podcast and they like what they hear is happening in the Snohomish Snoqualmie Valley area, and they want to start giving to Snow Valley Tilth. Can you talk a little bit about what donations do for your organization?
Sure thing. So donations do so much for us. We have a handful of different programs that are greatly benefited by the donations that we get. We have several main programs. The first is the Experience Farming Project, which...
That's a cool name.
Yeah. It is. It's nice to see it in action. So it's a program where experienced farmers lease land with infrastructure and soil work included so that they can really focus on just starting their farm businesses.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
So it's a farm business incubator.
Nice.
Wow.
And it's we're in year six of the program and really watching it grow, which is really exciting.
That's cool. Yeah.
We have our Carnation Farmers Market, which is a way that we connect with local food consumers, as well as create a market for those farmers at the Experience Farming Project to have a direct market sales opportunity.
So when you say carnation, do you mean the flower or the city?
The city.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Yeah. You can grow flowers.
That's very true. I mentioned, I think, our farmland network, which, you know, helps connect farmers to landowners who are interested in leasing their land. We have a rather new program of business support services, really helping farmers gain knowledge and information about how to maintain and start a healthy business.
Right.
Nice.
As well as educational opportunities for business development. So like technical resources and things like that, information about growing practices. So donations help sort of support and make more stable all of those programs.
Excellent.
It can be somewhat insecure to rely on grant funding from year to year.
Sure. Yeah,
so really we can use all the help we can get from individual supporters.
Awesome. Absolutely. That's excellent. Great pitch.
It's not so it's like there's these, like, the boogeymen get used on both sides, right? So like the organic farming for folks who are on a certain side, it's like you know, that stuff's all dirty and you know, like it's not really sustainable and all that sort of stuff, and it's only 30%. And then on the other side, it's like, well, now there are big agro farms who are just claiming that they're organic, but only 20% is. It's like this madness that's going on.
I think the reality in this region is that even large-scale commercial agriculture is having a really difficult time.
Yeah.
And I think moving forward into the future, you talked a lot about, you know, development pressures.
Yeah.
As an agricultural community, we need to, all farmers of different scale and, you know, production practices need to come together and really decide
Where this is going.
Yeah, the best way to make our voices heard.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you have any upcoming events coming up that you'd like to highlight?
We do. We have our annual farm fair and pig roast.
You had him at pig roast.
As a meatitarian.
Oh, man.
It is Saturday, September 15th, coming right up.
Let me write that down.
From 3 to 7 p.m. You can. It's located in the Snoqualmie Valley at Jubilee Farm. You can get tickets and more information at our website, www.snowvalleytilth.org.
Nice. Excellent.
And you said that's an annual event?
It's an annual event, yes. Okay. You can plan on that pig roast every year.
Awesome.
Nice.
Well, excellent. Hey, thank you very much, Libby, for coming on the show and talking a little bit about Snow Valley Tilth and sharing some really interesting information on organic and sustainable farming and then its impact in the area. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Awesome. Okay, so that was Libby talking about her organization. And I mean, it was pretty interesting conversations.
Do you feel like you're more educated now? You've got a little more farming and harvest knowledge?
Yes. I feel like I'm a little bit more. I mean, anytime we do these where I don't know anything about the topic, it's pretty cool. You feel like your brains get a little
bit. You want to go out there and grow some more carrots,
maybe? I didn't say that.
Okay. I won't hold you to it.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
First of all, I'm not really that good of a grower. I'm not like a good. I feel like I'm not a
if
good.
If you could grow meat plants, you could probably do that, wouldn't you?
Oh, man. Like, don't even get me started. If I could grow meat plants,
yeah,
I would grow the best steak you've ever seen.
I wonder, too, like, would you consider a cow a meat plant? I mean, just.
Well, yeah, it doesn't really move, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a meat plant in and of itself already.
Right?
It, like, moves, like, 3 feet a day. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Nope. So you have some interesting stats on farming and harvesting. So why don't you share those with us?
Yeah. So I got this information about how many people get food assistance from Washington State pantries, food pantries in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
1.16 million people did.
Wow.
In 2017.
That's unbelievable.
And there's this thing. We talked a little bit about it with Rotary First Harvest, the difference between food waste and food lost. But food waste... There were 40% food waste.
Oh, yeah. I hear that all the time. That's really crazy. That's half the food.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? We're guilty of it, too.
Yeah. Everybody is. Yeah. Yeah. So also something that I talked about with David with Rotary First Harvest is a lack of skilled laborers.
Mm.
Like, laborers just aren't existing anymore. Yeah. Nobody wants these jobs.
What? Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, in there is this website called Washington. It's called pickingjobs.com, and I can post that to the podcast. But they have a ton of available jobs right now.
Right. We talk about it all the time. Farms. The fact that there are, like, 6.8 million unemployed and 6.5 million jobs available.
Yeah.
They just so happen to be in sectors like this where people who maybe went to college think it's beneath them or something.
Yeah. And it's hard work.
Yeah, it is hard work.
Physical labor, hard work.
But there is something to be said for hard work.
Yeah. But then I have some trivia.
Oh, good. Oh, I like this.
Okay. So I would like you to guess in 2016, Washington State's top crops.
Okay.
Now, these are crops, not meat plants. Okay.
Well, I was going to say meat, but then that's
not... Then you were like, no, that's not. So 2016, Washington State top crops, go.
I'm going to say apples.
Number one. Oh, there was $2.4 billion worth of apples in 2016.
Okay.
Number one.
Do they count alfalfa as a
not on this list.
Okay, so it's not even on.
Actually, you know, when I said meat plants, I was wrong.
Oh, there is meat?
Yeah, cattle's number four.
Oh, so it kind of is like, well, you know, I mean, it's one of our crops, right?
It is,
cattle's
yeah.
one of our crops.
Yeah.
Okay. Hold on.
Eight more to go, pal.
Oh, man. Right off the top of my head, I'm going to say, grapes?
Dude, that was a random guess, and that's number nine.
Oh, get out of here.
Yeah. Nice job.
And then finally, I'm going to just go on a limb and say asparagus.
Nope.
Okay. What do we got?
So number 10, pears.
Oh, I was going to say that.
So like apples. Okay. So I said apples is $2.4 billion in 2016. Yeah. Pears is $233 million. So that's the kind of range
we're talking about. Okay. Wow.
That's
pretty
big discrepancy. As far as our exports and our growing. So pears is number 10. Grapes, you got number 9.
Uh-huh.
Hops, number 8.
Oh, you know, it was weird. I was thinking that too because, you know, we're
beer, the microbrew capital
of the world. Yeah.
Number 7 is hay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't have guessed that ever. Yeah. Number 6, cherries.
Yeah, makes sense. I do love that.
Mm-hmm. Number 5 is wheat.
Well, it's all going into the barley.
That's right.
It's going into the beer.
Number 5 and number 8, living together happily.
Yep.
Number 4 is cattle, so meat plants.
Uh-huh.
Number 3, potatoes.
Mm. That's right, because Grant County, shout out to Grant County and the 6 people that live there.
It
is the highest potato producing county in America. Eat that, Idaho.
And scene. Number 2 is milk, and then number 1 is apples.
Okay. You know, I to be fair to the milk thing, that feels a little bit
convoluted there.
Yeah, because I would have said milk.
Billion.
I would have said milk if the word crops weren't in there, right? That doesn't feel like a crop.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's awesome.
Yes.
I love trivia.
I know you do.
I know.
That's why I try to work it in. I don't always do it so successfully, but
this one was good. This one was good. So anyway, thank you very much for listening to this podcast. It is, as I said, September 28th. So we are going to be knee deep in the campaign. A reminder that the Daily Drip podcast starts on Monday. We're going to highlight the first week to give.
Yeah,
that is our major upcoming event, is the first week to give. Next week, anybody who starts a donation of $5 to, through their paycheck to any of the charities in the CFD program, yeah, ups your current donation $5, or even volunteers 1 hour and then logs it,
yes,
in the system, you will get a $5 Starbucks card.
Yay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's easy. Just,
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, do it.
So easy. And so look out for that starting next week. It runs from October 1st through 7th. The 7th Annual Masquerade Ball is right around the corner, believe it or not, October 20th.
Yeah, it's going to be big.
Yeah, it will be big. This is probably, we've listened to everybody who had comments about the last couple Masquerade Balls, and we've changed a lot, yeah, about it. Things will be placed in different areas. We'll have different things that we're highlighting. For those who got a chance to get in on the VIP experience, we'll have a whole new VIP experience,
yeah,
different entertainers. This is going to be probably one of the most interesting masquerade balls that we've ever done.
In the history of all masquerade balls?
That's correct.
Boom.
Boom. So those are some of the upcoming events that we will be a part of as the CFD. And then, of course, in your own agencies, you'll probably see some different activities happening in the month of October, November, and December.
Yeah.
So that is it for today's podcast talking about farming and harvest. We will talk to you later.
Bye.